newcomer asks, you may have seen this box in the back of the room on it, it says the newcomer asks. It sits there along with some 3x5 cards and pencils, and what we like to have people do is write down questions that they have about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, put them in this box, and we select one each week to be answered using AA-approved literature and our own panel of experts. To answer this week's question, we have selected our own Bill H.
I mean, I'm okay, still happen. And I completely forgot I was doing this. The question is, how does it feel to be sober and to be around addicts and have a great time when they're near? And I don't have a lot of experience with this question, as it turns out. I remember when I was first trying to stay sober, I felt kind of guilty about how I was trying to live my life, you know, sober, and some of my friends who had been involved in a lot of the same things that I had been involved in, it felt kind of like I was a little bit of, what's that word? A hypocrite. I felt kind of a little bit like a hypocrite, you know? And I felt afraid that maybe my friends who were still drinking using might judge me as a hypocrite because I didn't want to spend a lot of time around them in some of the same places that we used to, you know, to drink and use things. The fear of waking up again with another hangover was a little bit more than the fear of them thinking I was a hypocrite. And so I found that as difficult as it seemed to be, I had to start cutting ties with people who were going to continue to live a life with active drinking and using drugs. So I think the essence of the question is a little bit around how do I make that break, right? How do I stop spending time around people and places that I've grown so accustomed to? And sometimes that can be very difficult, but I know for me, until the pain of doing things the same got to be greater than the pain of change, I kept coming here getting newcomer checks, you know? And so I would say that I certainly do find myself occasionally at family events, like, for example, funerals or more joyfully at weddings and things like that, where some people who may or may not have a drinking or drug problem may find themselves. And I try to be pleasant with them. I try to be polite, but I don't really spend a lot of time and I, you know, hang around with them. And I certainly don't put myself in a position where the decision about whether or not I should drink becomes a real active proposal for me, you know? So anyway, that's my take. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill. It is now time for our featured speaker of the evening. This is brought to you by the Valley Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, the undefeated, undisputed king of speaker meetings. This event is brought to you for your sobriety pleasure. And now, let's get ready for recovery. Our speaker has been a sober member of the fellowship since 12-26 of 09. He has been continually in service as a secretary, business chairman, H&I representative, and sponsor. His AA motto is, at least for tonight, I am not unique. And now, with all the earnestness at your command, will you welcome, please, from Fresno, California, Tim D.
Hello. Hi everyone, my name is Tim, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi Tim.
My sobriety date is December 26th of 2009. Thank you. I didn't come here out of virtue. I didn't come here because I wanted to become a better person. You know, I didn't come here because I wanted to write a 400-page inventory or make amends to these people that I stole from and hurt. You know, that wasn't my plan when I got here. I was first court ordered to AA when I was 21, and that was right after I got my third DUI. I picked up my third DUI a week before I turned 21. So I mean, that kind of gives you an idea that at a very young age, alcohol, my drinking would get me into a lot of trouble. You know, and I remember seeing the judge and talking to the judge, and the DA wasn't very happy. I guess the judge liked it being very lenient, you know. And I remember one thing specifically. She said, Mr. Dobell needs to know if he gets another DUI, he goes to prison for a year mandatory. You know, and the crazy thing about that is that I continued to drink and drive. You know. You know, the three DUIs, that isn't what qualifies me being an alcoholic. I come from a history of alcoholics. You know, both my dad and my stepdad, they both were daily drinkers. I remember it was hard when I first came to AA. I would hear people talking about this mental obsession and the physical craving, right? That makes me different from normal people. If it just made sense, you know, that's what I was born into, and that's what I grew up around. You know, people, when you start drinking, you want more, something kicks off, and you just want to keep going until you black out. You know, that's what I saw my mom and dad doing. You know, they would drink, everything would be cool, and they both get drunk, and there'd be a big old fight. Cops would come, you know, and then you turn it on me, you know, and there was one time that I remember my dad, like I said, he was a big guy, really big guy, right? Kind of guy, a raw tail when it came to the jeans, you know, that he picked me up by one hand by my neck, and he put me through the wall, you know, and it was just very dysfunctional. You know, that was just like one instance, but I didn't see anything wrong with that. But from an early age, I knew that something was wrong. I had a hard time. I had a really hard time just being pinned. I remember I was committed one time for like a 72-hour suicide watch when I was 15. You know, and that, you know, looking back on that, I wasn't drinking every day, and I wasn't using every day. This is the shit that I was feeling sober. Anyways, I get to AA. I just went to meetings. You know, that first time I was court ordered, I had one of those slips that I hate to sign. You know, I thought it was real clever. So I couldn't make it to the meetings. You know, so I went to like 5 or 10, and I got 5 or 10 different signatures. Then I went, I got my girlfriend and my sister and all their friends. I got them all to board them, you know, and write. I had like 5 or 6 different girls writing these signatures, so it didn't look like one person was forcing on me. You know what I mean? It flew. The judge bought it, you know. I kept drinking. You know, drugs are a part of my story too. The thing about it though, you know, I use drugs, I use opiates daily for like 6 years. I know this is an AA meeting, but I find it important to talk about this, you know. That's what I thought my problem was. I would have told you I was still on blue in the face that I was a drug addict. You know, I had no problem admitting that I was a drug addict. The alcohol was a different story. I couldn't connect the two. I just had this utter inability to see anything wrong with what I was doing. it just didn't fit, you know. I was talking about, you know, the mental obsession and the physical craving, you know, and really early on, I hooked up with these Bigfoot supper guys, and they were real careful never to share with me their kinks, you know. And I remember when I got here this last time, I was unemployable. I was about 30 pounds underweight. I was bleeding when I go to the bathroom. I just remember being in my room. I was sleeping. Like, I'd have to have a bottle, like a pint or whatever I could afford. I'd have to have it in bed with me. Because I'd wake up at like 3 or 4 in the morning and I'd be shaking. And I'd need to go back to sleep, you know what I mean? And I reached this point. I remember that I just didn't care. I didn't really care if I lived or if I died anymore. And I just gave up. Sometimes, most of the time, I prayed that I wouldn't wake up, you know. I remember one day that there was one day in particular I was sitting on the foot of my bed and I had a bottle next to me. I don't remember. I think it was wine. That was my brilliant plan. You know, I was drinking so much. It said I couldn't stop. I had to keep drinking or I'd get really sick. Right? I'd start shaking really bad. So I figured it out. I was like, okay, I'm gonna go to the liquor store and I'm gonna get a bottle of wine. Right? Wine Goodwin. Snapchat. So I went, you know, I went and I got a bottle, I think it was a bottle of Barefoot Shiraz or whatever, it's at the liquor store, it's a really cheap wine. And I get there and I see the wine, and I go to grab one, and I'm like, this little voice in my head says, you better get two. So I got two bottles and I went home and I drank in the knee. You know, it didn't even make me feel better. And that's what alcohol started doing for me all up across the board, whether it was beer, booze, wine. It wasn't making me feel better. It wasn't fixing me anymore. Right? I stopped doing it. You know, I remember sitting on the foot of my bed with a bottle of wine left, and I just, I accepted my fate. And I said, this is me, you know, this is how I'm gonna, you know, this is who I am, and this is how I'm gonna die. And the scary thing about it is looking back, the thought that I might not have to live anymore brought me ease and comfort. Because it was that hard. It was that hard for him to be him. sorry, I get chills when I'm going to talk about this. I can't explain it. I couldn't tell you why at the time, but shortly thereafter, I sobered up. And I got, I got my first sponsor, and he gave me a list of things to do every day. You know, he told me, okay, you need to make your bed every morning. You need to call 3 people off the phone list. You need to get back into school. You need to find yourself a job. You need to get registered for DUI classes, right? Telling me I need to fix all this stuff on the outside, you know. And I started doing it, you know. And the next thing you know, he stopped returning my phone calls, and for whatever reason, it didn't work for me. That wasn't sufficient. So I got with my sponsor that I have today, and we're sitting in his truck. He started asking me questions, and he asked me, what's my experience? What's my experience with this mental obsession? The thought that was seeking for strength. What is my experience with that? I can think back. I had this job. I worked for this restaurant. I was a bartender, and I was actually a trainer. I did everything. You know, they loved me there. Actually, I managed to get fired from this place 3 different times. And on the third time I was fired, the reason they fired me is because I stayed there after work and I was drinking. I went out and it ended up being like a 2-day run. You know, I was drinking for like 2 days straight. And at some point I blacked out, and during my blackout I went behind this bar and I started peeing all over the well liquor bottle, all in the ice, in the trash can. And I didn't remember any of it. So they took me home and I woke up early the next morning, like 6 in the morning. I went down to a local bar room, and by the time I woke up there's no liquor store open yet. So I went down to the casino, I hopped on the bus, I went to the casino, and like as soon as 6 o'clock was around, I got a black grand. Lost all my money, went to my buddy's house, passed out on his son's bed, and then, came to a little bit, and then I went into work the next day, and they said, did you, sit behind the bar? And I said, no, I didn't do that. So there's no way I did that, and I believed it with all my heart. I said, there's no way I would remember something like that. And then two of the managers said, come here, we need to talk to you. And then they took me in the back, and they didn't even give me a check. They just gave me cash. They said, here's your check. We cashed it for you. We need you to leave. You're no longer an employee here anymore. And then I tried arguing with them, and my manager, Shannon, who's more like a sister, she stopped me abruptly. She said, you want to take the videotape? We have you on tape. And I said, no, I believe me. That's all I need to hear. She said, I was on tape. So this is the most embarrassing thing that has ever happened to me from drinking. And what did I do? I moseyed on out, and I sat at the bar, and I ordered a beer. And I started drinking, and the book also talks about the strange mental blank spot, and I knew that there was something wrong in me, but really, I couldn't, like I said earlier, I couldn't connect the two. I couldn't see that alcohol was part of the problem, So, when I got here, he was asking me about the obsession and the craving, and I started naming off all these different experiences I have with the obsession and the craving, and then he asked me the question, million-dollar question. He asked me if I was ready to never drink again, and I told him, yeah, but in my heart, I knew that wasn't possible. That's just not something that's possible for me. The way that I drink and the way that I act, I always go back to it. And that's just how I do it. But I'm telling them, yeah. Right? And it's not that I wanted to go back out and start drinking myself underweight again and start drinking till my eyes were yellow and bleeding when I went to the bathroom. That was never what I wanted to do. But that's always what ended up happening, right? And I went home later that night, I talked to my sponsor, and I opened my book, through no directions from him, I opened my book to page 30, more about alcoholism, and on that first page, it says in black and white, it's the great obsession of every abnormal drinker, is that somehow, someday, he will beat the game, or it'll be different. I don't know if that's specific, verbatim, but that was the first time ever that I was seeing myself experiencing that obsession. I kind of had almost like an out-of-body experience, because I'd never seen that before, and it never made sense. And for the first time ever, it made sense. And I got really scared, and I started crying, and I was smiling at the same time, because for the first time ever, I saw what the problem was. And that gave me hope. It gave me hope that there might be a solution, there might be another side of this thing. I got really uncomfortable. I was sober for about 30 days and it was cool. I was like, well, I'm sleeping better and I can eat again and people don't mind being around me so much. You know, I wasn't really, you know, that successfully antisocial guy that it became when I drank. But shortly thereafter, I got more uncomfortable in sobriety than I ever was drinking. There's another part of this book, page 52. Me and my friends, we like to call it a bedevilment exercise. And it was pointed out to me, right here, because we had to ask ourselves, why shouldn't we apply our human problem? The same readiness, the change our point of view. We were having trouble with personal relationships. We couldn't control our emotional nature. We were afraid of misery and depression. We couldn't make a living. Had a feeling of uselessness, full of fear. We were unhappy. We couldn't seem to be a real help to other people. Now, these things, this isn't what I was feeling when I was drinking and the alcohol was still working for me. All that stuff slipped away when the alcohol was my solution. This is the stuff that happened to me after I've been sober a little while. Right? That's why being sober for me was so unsatisfactory. When I got here, I knew that it had to be something much more than just being sober. Especially for the rest of my life. That's something I have to get committed to forever. And it's got to be something way more, way better than what alcohol did for me. So, you know, I found myself even more hopeless and sobriety because the reality of my condition became pretty clear. You know, and I launched into my fourth step. And it took me about 6 months to write it. And I didn't understand a whole lot of it while I was doing it. You know, looking back in retrospect, it makes a lot of sense, but I didn't understand it. You know, I just was kind of like had this blind faith, and my sponsor was quoting me the book. He said, okay, you do it like this, and then you write this out, and then, you do the prayers before you write, and I didn't question it. I just did it. You know, I did it, and I went through and I did my resentments, my fears, and my sex inventory, and I got some new sex ideals. And you know that the sex ideals, you know, I'm sure I have to point out to me like it is. It's a lot more than it's something that's very important to me. It's really it's a God-given ideal that I found. Let me jump back. So that night I had my first sense of experience when I went home and I read that page on chapter 30. You know, essentially I had my second sense of experience too. You know, on the window shade version of the stuff. One says we admitted we're powerless over alcohol. Dash, their lives have become unmanageable. Two says came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And that night, you know, I was seeing something I'd never seen before. And it wasn't anything that came from me, you know. So that gave me a little, and I didn't have a whole lot of issues, you know. Again, I was willing to get on my knees and pray to whatever the hell you told me I needed to pray to. I didn't really have anything standing in between me and my first conception of God when I was brand new. There was a spiritual terms exercise that I was shown. You pray and you ask God to help you set aside everything that you think you know about God, and so that you could be opened up for a new experience with God. And I did, you know, and I did that. And the first thing that came up, what came off my pen, was keeper of sanity. That's all I wanted. That's all I wanted. I just wanted this to stop. This fucking madness, you know. So I go through and I did my fourth step and I had about right around 6 months sober. Yeah, I changed my mind. And I said, screw AA, you know, this is stupid. You know, they're all stupid. I can get another 6 months, you know what I mean? it just really isn't life or death for me, you know. It wasn't really that bad, you know, the stuff that was rolling around into. So I told my buddy, my roommate, I said, hey, I'm gonna drink tonight. And he looked at me and he said, you sure you wanna do that? And I said, yeah, I'm sure I wanna do that. So I came in, we went to Save Mart, and we got an 18 pack of Bud Light. And we went to our buddy Brandon's house. And we got there, put the beer in the fridge, and my roommate Vince, he said, I don't care if you drink, but I'm not gonna give one to you. You gotta give it yourself. You know, and for whatever reason, something inside me wouldn't let me do it. I couldn't do it. You know, I couldn't do it. You know, so I went home and then I recommitted to my fourth step and I finished it. I finished my fourth step and I fifth-stepped it, you know, and I've heard in a lot of meetings that people have eggs to the grave list. You know, certain things that they're not willing to disclose or discuss with another person. It wasn't my experience, you know. I put every single little thing down. I shared every sick thought, every secret that I have, I got on paper, and I shared it with my sponsor. And right when I was done, I can't really complain. It, you know, it was just very serene. Yeah, you know, I didn't have all that noise. You know, all that noise it kind of disappeared. You know, and I couldn't understand it. You know, I couldn't understand it, but there's some sort of magic to the fourth step. You know, and I don't know. I don't understand the mechanics, you know what I mean? I know what I was shown, and I did it without question. And I know that it works. You know, I've done another one since. You know, the same thing happens. Rolled into 6 and 7, I saw that there's a lot of stuff I'm not willing to let go of. So I go through and I look at all that stuff, and that's what I take into my 7th step. My 6th step is all the stuff that I'm not willing to let go of in my 4th step. And that's what I take to God. You know, that's what I take to God. When we say the prayer, God, I'm not willing that you have all of me, the good and the bad. And then there's kind of a, the book's kind of tricky. We get to the 8th step, and it says we have a list of people we harmed. We made it when we took inventory. And I said, wait a minute. These are people I was angry at. and it seems like, the funny thing is, in every run on my inventory, I still have some amends left. I have some financial ones, or I have some people that are out of town, you know, but there's about 100 altogether. And the first one at the very tip top of my list was dad, mom, sister, brother-in-law. It seems like the people who are closest to me are the ones I had the most resentment towards, you know. And I did the fourth step in such a fashion. You know, when we get to the fourth column, where we've been selfish, dishonest, inconsiderate, or afraid, for self-seeking. Yeah, I'm sorry, self-seeking and frightened. You know, it's easy for me to see that I harm these people, you know. So I went out. My sponsor said, you know, at this point I still have a little bit of doubt. I still run off some of my own ideas. You know, I'm not really giving God all the power yet, you know, because I'm, you know, maybe I'm just not thoroughly convinced, you know. Maybe, like he hasn't done enough already, you know. So I go out and I started making amends, you know, and, there's a couple, there's one amends I made. I worked for this company. It's a federally funded company. really big corporation. And when I worked there, I used to steal. You know, I stole these prescription drugs like OxyContin and Morphine and Percocet and Methadone and all this. And I would sell them. I mean, I knew this guy would pick it up for me right away. He'd give me like $1,000 a bottle. You know, in the beginning, it was one of those amends that I thought I'd never make. You know, I've never, that was one of the ones that I didn't think I'd be able to do. You know, because, you know, the whole jail thing, getting in trouble. But something happened, you know, got in me and really gave me this willingness. It is like kind of like God was tapping me on the shoulder saying, you need to go out there and you need to do this. You know. So I found this guy, I found my manager that was working there, the one that actually fired me for another reason. And I found him, I tracked him down. You know, it took me a little while, it took me about a week. It took me about a month. Hitting his phone calls and not returning my call, but I got a hold of him. And he worked here in Vitalia, you know, so I came from Fresno down here to Vitalia. And you know, I prayed before I went in there, and I marched up the stairs to his office, and I knocked on the door, you know, and I'm no judge and I'm no lawyer, but I was convinced that I was going to go away for a long time. You know, that's like a serious offense in my head. You know? So I go up there and I knock on the door. And he says, come on in. I sit down and I lay it all out there. I said, this is who I am. This is why I work for you. And this is what I did. You know, I'm not proud of who I was. And I'm not proud of what I did. And we started talking. You know, we had like this crazy conversation. Like, he started talking about his kids, you know. And I did my utmost. I asked if I needed to go, do I need to go up any higher? And he said, no, you don't need to go up any higher. I turned around and I started walking away, and he stopped me and said, if you need anyone to call and verify that you're here, making this amends, you know, just give my number. And I looked back, and it was the first time ever that I realized, I'm not court ordered to make these amends. This isn't my dad walking me back into bonds. Returning the candy, right? Which happened, by the way, when I was 5 years old. My dad marched my ass back in the barn and they got the manager and said, we need to get this back to the manager. No, it wasn't any of that. You know, I looked back at him and I said, this isn't really me being accountable to someone else. This is really what this is really about. And it just kind of hit me like a ton of bricks. What this is about is me being accountable to God and being accountable for what I did, you know. Making right, getting right here with my fellow man. Because the truth is, I'd rather pay the penalty. I was willing to do that, you know. I'd rather go and I'd rather take care of it here now instead of going before my Creator with it when I die. I was about 9 months sober, you know, when I had this, the 12th step talks about having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. You try to hear this message of the alcoholics and practice these principles in all of our affairs. I was about 9 months sober in there. Just like our disease, there's three parts to the disease of alcoholism. You know, the mental obsession, the thought that precedes the first drink, the physical craving, that thing that kicks off me that doesn't let me stop. That I don't know where I'm going to go, or how long I'm going to drink, or how far down it's going to take me. And then there's the spiritual malady that I never really understood. And there's a lot of words I didn't understand when I was in, so I'd look them up. Malady means a sickness. It doesn't work properly. I'm spiritually sick. That's what I found out. You know, and about 9 months sober, just like our threefold disease, it became real clear to me that the makeup of the human being is three parts too. right? There's a physical part, you know, there's my skin, my fingers, and my flesh and bones, and then there's the mental part, right? My sense of reasoning. There's this other side that I've never really been familiar with. I've never even really been interested in at all until I was about 9 months sober. And I have a hard time describing anything spiritual, but maybe some of you can relate. Like when I go to my sister's house and my 3-year-old niece runs up to me and she says, "I want to hold you." Right? Instead of, "Hey, hold me," she says, "I want to hold you." And I pick her up and she squeezes me with all she has, and then something happens to me, right? Something happens and I feel happier than I feel connected. I'm feeling love, you know what I mean? And I believe it's my belief that the love that I'm feeling is the kind of love that God intended. And it's nothing I think my way into, and it's nothing that I physically move my way into. It's something that happens all on its own. It just happens, you know what I mean? And I see my sister's dog, you know what I mean? Or when I see an older couple, you know, that are walking down the street holding hands, you know. It's just, you know, we're all, you know, it's my belief that we're all connected on a certain level. And, you know, I've been blocked. There's been something that stood in the way between me and that for a long time. The 12-step process has enabled me to clear some of that stuff out. Open up the pipeline between me and God. And it's not, you know, it isn't, you know, the happiness I was looking for I realized that the happiness I was looking for wasn't going to come from, you know, the car or the house the job, or if I only had more money, or if I only had a fucking boat, or if they didn't give me a Harley, or I need all of their respect. I need everyone to respect me, right? This is where I was looking, or if I could only, you know, drink one beer, two beers, you know what I mean? That's all I want to do. You know, I'm looking for the sense of connectedness that kind of was talking about when I see my sister's, you know, my niece, you know. I'm looking for that feeling everywhere else on the outside, right? I had to consider that maybe that feeling I was looking for, that happiness, because I believe that we all want to be happy. We all want to be happy. Right? That's my belief. I don't think there's anyone that actually gets pleasure out of being angry, you know, and being balanced up with the lies and being discontent. I don't believe that. That's just not my truth. You know, I think we all want to be happy, but for me, I consider that happiness, that true happiness I was looking for, was something that came from within, rather than the result of all the shit on the outside, right? That I've been chasing for the last 30 years. I wasn't born with these ideas. No, I wasn't born. I wasn't born with the idea that if I made more money, I'd be happier. Right? I wasn't born with the idea that I need a house. A wife, kids, a really good job to be successful. You know, I wasn't born with that. I learned all this stuff along the way. So, that's what AA has done for me. You know, it was really uncomfortable. I'm not gonna lie that. And I'm not, trust me guys, I'm not surfing a rainbow to Jesus, you know, that's not me. But I definitely have a relationship with a higher power, you know, I've definitely become awake to the spiritual side of life, you know. And that part of me is every bit as real as the other two parts. And it also, it needs to be fed, it needs to be nourished. For me, you know, when I let that stuff slide, you know, that's when I start feeling all these things I don't want to feel. This is where my fear, my uselessness, all these bad feelings I don't want to feel, that's where that stems from. It's my spiritual sickness. Right? Stuff doesn't happen to me when I'm in a spiritually sick condition, when I'm doing everything that I'm supposed to be doing. So what it's like now. Today I had a lady tell me, thank you for being you. You know, and that people never used to say that shit. She says, thank you for being you. And I go to work, and my boss pulled me aside, this is right when I was brand new at the job I had. She pulled me aside, and she goes, you're one of the good guys. And I was like, really? You must not know me very well. I've stolen a lot of stuff, I've treated people, I've hurt a lot of people. I'll share this one story. I heard this story one time. I think it sums it up pretty good. Imagine Jesus Christ is riding into Jerusalem on a donkey, right? And everyone's blowing flowers out in the street, and everyone's clapping, and they're so happy. And what if the donkey thought that was about him? I guess what I'm trying to get at is when I'm asked to do things like this, it can make me feel pretty important, but at the end of the day, I'm just a jackass carrying a message.